Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is titled China's Overreach and Its Derailment. Recorded in 2023, McQuestion Program Perspectives Matter co-host Jim Falk interviews Susan Shirk, PhD, research professor, and chair of the 21st Century China Center at UCSD, and author of Overreach, How China Derailed Its Peaceful Rise, and David Feierstein, president and CEO of the George H.W. Bush Foundation for U.S.-China Relations, on the topic of America's foreign policy relations with China and China's domestic situation. We hope you enjoyed today's episode, and don't forget to subscribe to the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
President Biden's National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan recently described China as the only competitor with both the intent to reshape the international order and the growing capacity to do it. So it's time for a China update. Just since our last program, in the last 2 months, President Biden and President Xi Jinping held a brief summit meeting in November. Widespread protests forced a change in the country's zero COVID lockdowns, and President Xi secured an unprecedented third term as China's leader. Today, 82% of Americans have an unfavorable view of China. That's a doubling since President Xi took power just over a decade ago. So what does all of this mean for what is undoubtedly our country's most complex and important bilateral relationship? To discuss these latest events and what 2023 might bring, let me introduce our two guests. Coming to us from the University of California, San Diego, where she is a research professor and chair of the 21st Century China Center, is Dr. Susan Shirk. Since visiting the country for the first time in 1971, her focus on China has included government service, teaching, and scholarship. She served as well in the Clinton administration as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, and her new book is Overreach, How China Derailed Its Peaceful Rise. David Feierstein is president and CEO of the George H.W. Bush Foundation for U.S.-China Relations, located in Austin. During his career as a U.S. Foreign Service officer, he focused on our relationship with China, and while living in China in the mid-1990s, David was the very first foreign citizen and diplomat to have a regular column in the People's Republic of China newspaper. It's great to see both of you, and thanks so much for taking time to be with us.
Great Thank to be you. Here.
So what I thought we would talk about 2 or 3 weeks ago has changed somewhat, and that is the result of the protests that took place. They were quite widespread. Susan, tell us, because I know that you have an ear very close to the ground, were you surprised that they took place and also by the momentum that occurred?
Yes, the protests were a big surprise to me. China has been surprising me quite a bit lately, which is really pretty interesting considering that I've been studying China since the 1960s, more than 50 years. These were the first nationwide protests against central government policy since Tiananmen, 1989. And I really was surprised because, from my point of view, the greatest risk to the stability of the Chinese Communist Party rule in China is not a bottom-up rebellion, but a split in the leadership. Because under Xi Jinping, he has consolidated so much power now, there is no power sharing anymore. And his decisions are really quite controversial among the party elite because many of them have backfired and been costly to China, including this long, stubborn clinging to the extreme zero COVID management of the epidemic.
It's a little bit like a child that pushes a little bit and has some success and goes a little bit farther. David, since they were able, these protests really compelled a change in the government, do you think we'll see more of this?
I think it's unlikely. And I would also say that I agree with Susan in her overall assessment of what happened with the protests. I was surprised as well. in particular about the fact that there were calls that were even shown on CNN and on video for Xi Jinping to step down and, you know, down with the Communist Party and so on. And that was shocking and striking. And just as Susan rightly noted, it's the first time we've seen that type of protest materialize in China in 33 years. And so that being said, I think the level of frustration and pent-up rage about these zero COVID policies that have been borne by the public of China for nearly 3 years now just boiled over. And I don't think it's every issue that is going to generate that type of outright rage and a sense of, wanting to speak out and be heard in such a dramatic way. So I don't think that we're going to see this as a trend line going forward. And it's obviously true that the Chinese powers that be certainly have the power, as we've seen and as we've always seen in China, dating back to 1989 and even earlier, to shut these things down once they reach a certain point.
Did the United States handle the time of the protest appropriately? As a former diplomat, are you comfortable with our reaction?
Well, I think the United States always stands strong for the notion that people ought to have the right to express themselves and take to the streets in peaceable assembly. Pursuant to China's own constitution, that is theoretically a right that is guaranteed in China. And I think it's right for the United States and other countries to stand up and say that that is that it's appropriate that people be permitted to do that. So I think broadly speaking, yes, I think the U.S. positioning on that was correct. And at the same time, I think the United States understands that probably the most prudent thing it can do is to stay out of the way and let the Chinese people express themselves and not give the Chinese authorities and the powers that be an opportunity to say this was fomented by the United States, which of course is something that they have claimed. So, I think broadly speaking, yes, the U.S. was well positioned on the issue.
Well, I think both of you would probably agree that our relations with China had been reaching a sort of a rock bottom. Henry Kissinger recently described the summit that was held between President Biden and Xi at the side of the Bali conference, the G20, as a beginning of a bridge-building effort. What has happened since then? I know that there was discussion about the Secretary of State, Tony Blinken, going to Beijing. Has there been any progress on that, and what other steps might be taken?
My impression from talking to my friends in the administration is that they came away from the Bali meeting with a very clear sense that the Chinese side was motivated to stabilize relations. You know, sometimes U.S.-China relations have to get really bad before they can improve. And I saw this when I came into government in 97, right after a Taiwan Strait crisis in 95, 96. And so both sides get really worried about the prospect of a shooting war, probably in the Taiwan Strait, and they recognize that they better get down to some old-fashioned diplomacy to try to head that off. And I'm feeling encouraged that after 6 years of pretty much zero diplomacy between the two sides, 4 years of Trump and 2 years of Biden, that the two sides may now make some progress. I wouldn't predict any great.
Well, that's good that you feel that way. But when President Biden came into office, I think people felt that this was an opportunity, a chance that there might be better relations. And hardliners, both the United States and in China, sort of put up obstacles. I wonder now, with the House of Representatives under Republican control and an election taking place in 2 years, is that going to create any type of hindrance or challenges for the Biden administration to foster better relations with this important country?
Well,
competitor.
Yes, it will. And so we've had 6 years to make the China threat the one area that the two parties can agree on. And that's not a good place to be if you want to be able to make the necessary compromises in order to stabilize relations, which, you know, and that's inevitable, that you have to make some compromises. So hopefully the Chinese side, hopefully there'll be some momentum at the diplomatic level so that people can see that it may still be possible to address some of our disputes through negotiations. And of course, the subtext of that is a certain amount of goodwill to the other side. You know, right now we use sanctions to punish and slow down China's capabilities, but I'd rather see us using those sanctions as leverage, threaten them before you impose them, say what we'd like the other side to do, and then decide whether or not to impose them or
not. As we know, it's a lot easier to impose sanctions than to remove them. Do you, David, will the tariffs be removed or lessened to some degree?
I don't think so. I think there was certainly a hope at the outset of the Biden administration that they would be either substantially reduced or rescinded altogether. And that hope, I think, had its roots in the fact that both candidate Joe Biden and candidate Kamala Harris said on their respective debate stages that they understood that it was the American people paying for the tariffs, contrary to what President Trump had said many hundreds of times during his term in office. And yet, when the Biden administration came in, they didn't take action on tariffs. And 2 years into the administration of President Biden, the tariffs are still there. They're bad for America. They're inflationary. They hurt consumers. They hurt producers. Widgets cost more. Factories have to raise their prices. Then they have to lay off workers. Nonpartisan estimates suggest that about 250,000 jobs have been lost as a direct result of tariffs. And they've done nothing to reduce the deficit, which is why Donald Trump ended up being the deficit president in American history, with the highest average annual merchandise deficit in American history, as measuring presidency against presidency, at an average figure. So the tariffs are a good example of how the politics of China in the United States drive bad policy. Good politics does not always equal good policy. And I've been disappointed, as I think many others have been, that some pretty misguided and self-harming policies, such as the tariffs and a few other things, are still on the books. They shouldn't be. But what's very clear is that, you know, American politicians are more afraid of being characterized as soft on China than they are of being characterized as soft on inflation.
While we're talking about business, I was really quite surprised to just see how high unemployment was now in China, particularly among youth ages 16 to 24. Moreover, that students are being encouraged to stay in school, go to graduate school, because there are no jobs. It seems to me that that's only going to get worse. And yet, on the other hand, China is faced with a demographic future. Susan, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, there are structural reasons that the Chinese economy is growing more slowly now. And one of the main ones is that the working age population has shrunk and there are a lot more older people. But a lot of the reasons for China's current economic struggles are Xi Jinping's policies, which really have been counterproductive, and especially his tough position on the private sector. Private business is where the jobs are in China, not state-owned enterprises. So back in 2021, he very suddenly went after the internet-based businesses, prevented them from listing their IPOs, imposed all sorts of tough regulations on them, and in fact wiped out one entire industry of the after-school tutoring business, which tragically is making it more difficult for middle-class parents to teach their kids English. Well, that's one of the main things that they use after-school tutoring for. But these are also big businesses. Some of them were listed in Hong Kong or even New York, I believe. So, you know, Xi Jinping is, frankly, a kind of paranoid leader. When you concentrate this much power, you see threats everywhere. And so he believes that the private business entrepreneurs are one of the groups that is so powerful that they could represent.
And Susan, what I find so interesting, especially at this point, is some of the analogies or similarities rather between Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping. And David, comment for us, elaborate on how the demise of the Soviet Union really is never out of the thoughts of President Xi.
Well, I think that's certainly true. You know, the basic understanding at the elite level in China, at the leadership level, is that, you know, the Soviet Union dissolved because fundamental strategic mistakes were made by the Soviet leadership. And basically, to paraphrase it, the idea that let's do political reform first and economic reform later is a view that has been widely discredited in China, in the minds of Chinese leaders, because of the experiences of Russia and the Russian Federation in the wake of the dissolution of the Soviet Union. And so the idea in China, the lesson, if you will, that was learned, I think, was the idea of, at that time, again, going back to the early 90s and kind of the heyday of China moving toward a more market-oriented economy and moving toward WTO accession, et cetera, the idea was let's do economic reform and be serious about it and move forward in a concerted way, but let's hold off on political reform. And that was, I think, the principal takeaway for the Chinese leadership from that period. But the last point I would make about it, Jim, is that now, as Susan rightly pointed out, you know, China is now backing away from that march toward economic opening and reform, or reform and opening, and moving toward a heavier state role in the economy than what we've seen in recent years, moving, if you will, backsliding in terms of what we've seen over the last several decades. And of course, that's having a deleterious impact on the Chinese economy and private industry and China's growth rates and employment and so on and so forth. So it is frankly puzzling for anyone looking at China and presuming that they would hope to grow as rapidly as possible, that China has embarked on these policies, which in fact are quite harmful to China's economy and to the people of China in many respects.
Well, as Ukraine is a factor, certainly in Vladimir Putin's thinking, Taiwan is to Xi. And I'm holding this article from The Economist that just came out recently, Will Taiwan Be the Ukraine of Asia? David, I know you've given a lot of thought to this issue, and we don't have a lot of time, but how much of a threat is it, a risk, that there will be some type of military invasion in Taiwan from China? From the mainland?
Well, the short answer, Jim, to that really good question is, in my judgment, every day that China doesn't go into Taiwan militarily is a day that evidently the leadership of China has judged that the costs of doing so outweigh the benefits of doing so. And I don't think anything about the Russia-Ukraine conflict and Russia's outright and unlawful, unprovoked, unjustified, and shameful invasion of Ukraine causes China's leaders to think about Taiwan differently. And I do not anticipate that anytime in the near future we will see a move on the part of the mainland to go into Taiwan militarily. And I think the reason is, you know, severalfold, but fundamentally the costs outweigh the benefits, not just in terms of the real possibility of conflict, not only with Taiwan itself, but also with the United States. That possibility is certainly out there. And it's been amplified by the remarks, recent remarks of President Joe Biden, in which he said the United States would send troops to defend Taiwan in such an eventuality. But also, perhaps more immediately and more realistically, the economic costs that would be generated by China doing that, and the degree to which China would be relegated and marginalized to a pariah state role
in the
world.
And we've seen that with Russia.
Exactly.
And we've seen that with Russia.
And I think they take away.
Susan, this is such an important question. Do you agree with David?
I do. And I think that right now, the United States and Taiwan are very focused on making sure that we have an effective military deterrent. And there's a lot of, I'd say, more realistic and creative thinking about how to defend Taiwan. In the past, Taiwan wanted big arms sales that were kind of a symbol of how much the United States loved and appreciated Taiwan. But now there's much more focus looking at Ukraine. How can Taiwan effectively defend itself? And one of the most significant developments is that Japan is viewing the defense of Taiwan as critical to its own national security. And that really does augment the deterrent posture of the United States, Taiwan, and our other allies.
So what's this porcupine strategy, David?
Well, I mean, I think the idea is to make Taiwan as prickly as it can be in a variety of different ways. And, you know, let's bear in mind that going into Ukraine on paved highways and on flat roads is one thing, but launching an amphibious assault with an untested military where no soldier has ever fought in combat, in going into a mountainous island where there's only a few points where you can even plausibly, you know, launch and wage an amphibious assault, that's a different matter. And so, as Susan has noted, I mean, the United States working with our friends in Taiwan, working with U.S. allies like Japan and others, has certainly been focused on maximizing our ability to deter an attack, you know, before one should ever happen. And, you know, I think there's an interesting question of whether the concept of strategic ambiguity continues to be the U.S. policy, given some of the things that President Biden has said as our sitting president and commander in chief, or whether we're moving toward a strategic clarity. But in any case, I think there's no question that the best summary of U.S. policy toward Taiwan and around the Taiwan issue is within the constraints of recognizing the government of the People's Republic of China as the sole legal government of China, we're going to do everything in our power as a nation to prevent China from taking over Taiwan and to prevent reunification. That's not the stated policy of our nation, but that, I think, is what we're trying to do.
We just have a few minutes left. And Susan, I'd like to ask you to comment on how comfortable are you and do you think it's the right way to frame our relationship with China or competition with China, autocracy and democracy?
Well, certainly China has become more autocratic under Xi Jinping. And actually, it's Xi Jinping who first started talking about system competition back at the 19th Party Congress 5 years ago. But I think I understand why Joe Biden in particular has emphasized the differences and the superiority of democracy over autocracy. It's a very useful focal point to try to mobilize bipartisan support behind his big, expensive domestic initiatives. And it made good domestic political sense, but it really didn't make good diplomatic sense because it what it said to the Chinese people is, it's not what you're doing or specific policies. It's your regime, your type of system. It's your character, if you will. And that's not the way to encourage the other side to start moderating its policies.
Right.
So I prefer a more practical diplomatic approach.
David, President Xi has certainly had a challenging year in 2022. How stable do you think his regime really is? Is there opposition that is floating about, especially considering that he has essentially declared himself president for life?
Well, from where I sit, and certainly not being privy to the internal workings of the Chinese political structures, et cetera, my sense is that he is going to be in power for a very long time. My sense is that China's system is going to last in its current form for a very long time. And yes, there are all kinds of policy challenges on the agenda of the leadership of China, from demographic challenges to economic challenges, public unrest, and all kinds of different issues, bad debt, the economy. But the one thing that to me strikes me about the Chinese system is its resiliency and its ability to adapt and muddle through and find a way forward, even when the doubters suggest that, China's on its last legs. I remember reading books, and I'm sure Susan remembers as well, talking in the 1980s about the coming collapse of China, and it just has never happened. I think Xi Jinping is very secure in terms of his hold on power, and I would be shocked if we saw any significant change in that regard in the foreseeable future.
I remember a number of years ago hearing Henry Kissinger speak about his book on China, and he reminded the audience that China had been around a lot longer than the United States. I wish we were around longer today to continue our conversation. I think it's quite clear why we do so many programs on China. There's not a more strategic relationship, and perhaps one that is faces more challenge than our bilateral relationship with China. I want to thank you both very much for being with us today. And to all of you, thank you for joining Perspectives. We're here talking about things that matter with people who care.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.